Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
In his new book, the historian Thomas LeCour looks at thousands of years of art, from prehistoric cave paintings to the most famous works in Western history. And he asks, why is it that dogs keep showing up? Have you ever noticed? It's weird, right? I mean, sometimes it makes sense, but sometimes a dog is just there coming into the frame. And LeCour says they're not just decoration. He says they're doing important work. They're moving the story or guiding your eyes or bearing witness. And he says they're also revealing something about us, illuminating our experience with joy or grief or loneliness. The book is more than art history. LeCour is also interested in how we evolved alongside dogs. Over time, he says, dogs developed this remarkable capacity to pay attention to us. It sharpened their social and visual intelligence, and he thinks it's the foundation of our bond. This is what he calls a dog's gaze. And you'll see it immediately in the painting on the cover of his book. This is from 1585. It's Bartolomeo Passarotti. It's called Man with Dog.
He chose a man in a ruffled collar, bearded man, black hat, looking out at us. But what struck me as so interesting and important is that the dog has his paws on the man's shoulder and is looking intensely at him.
The dog and the human are hugging each other, his hands, fingers spread, flesh on fur, holding tightly the dog's shoulder, the dog's white paws on his doublet. But the most striking aspect is the centrality of the act of seeing itself. The dog looks intently into the face of the man who is holding him. The man is looking out at us as if he were suddenly disturbed by someone coming in, as if moments before he had been looking at the dog. His look demands that viewers take notice of what the dog is doing. Seeing him.
My feeling is that the man is just looking out at us as if to turn back to the dog, to get our attention, to say, look, the dog is looking at me. So in one sense, it's a right angle look. The dog is looking at him, and he's looking out at us. I interpreted his look, or I was drawn into his look, by the notion that it's asking us to note the dog's gaze, and that he's going to return to looking at his dog as soon as he's gotten our attention. It's a striking picture. My editors thought it was the perfect picture, and so we arrived at that very early in the process of producing the book.
You say the really critical part of the picture itself is the centrality of the act of seeing itself. What do you mean? Why is that important? Why is that such a striking aspect for what you're getting at?
Painters are interested in dogs seeing us because we are interested in dogs seeing us. And I meant gazing as an attentive seeing, involved seeing, intelligent seeing. And dogs do this all the time, and we're clearly interested in it. And we've been interested in it as a species for as far back as there's been art. So that's what struck me. And I think seeing what they're seeing is what attracted us to dogs in the first place 25,000 years ago. And I think that's because the act of seeing between humans, in fact, is the way we recognize each other. We connect through our eyes. And so dogs, in that sense, are almost human-like in that they connect with us through seeing. So that's why the gaze is the central feature, central issue in the book, and how artists use this gaze and why we're attracted to this gaze.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thomas LeCour, he's with us today. He's an emeritus professor of history at UC Berkeley. His book is called The Dog's Gaze. How do you describe your relationship with dogs? Your family had them when you were growing up, but you say that it didn't seem to take. It was kind of shallow, your relationship, and vicarious.
My mother loved her dogs and had a great affinity for them and took care of them, but I don't remember my relationship. It was a passing and casual relationship through my mother, really. When my daughter was I guess, 5 or 6, we got a dog, especially what as children do. And I was just struck and kind of amazed by this dog's, the intensity of this dog's looking at stuff. We named the dog Curious. So I think probably that's what got me interested.
Well, you mentioned how your history with dogs is companions in your life and in your work. This is something you were getting at, had allowed you to recognize something beyond the personal about dogs in art was worth exploring. But did you know what that was? Like, there's something, it's not just that I like dogs or I've learned to love dogs now, but that there's something in these, like, were you seeing motifs? Were you seeing something that made you think, there's something there I want to talk about or write about?
Well, you know, yes and no. And it's an interesting question just about how I work, about how anyone works for that matter. I didn't come to this topic or any of my topics because I knew in advance what I wanted to say about them. I kept asking myself, why am I interested in looking at these pictures? And then I became interested in, once I saw how many dogs there were in British art, I became interested in seeing them looking elsewhere. And I was just overwhelmed by every art gallery you go into. There they are. And not just, you know, in the corner of this and that painting, but central to the major paintings of the Western canon. So I started thinking about, why are they there? And it took me a long time to figure out an answer. It came to me very slowly that what mattered about dogs and art was just their intensities, which they were doing all this looking. And that then got me into the evolutionary history and the ethology of dogs. People have been interested in the dog's look and being the relationship of how dogs look to how babies look. And then it opened up a whole world of vision. So I crept up on the topic, and it took, I think, till 2020, before this one I started writing the book, for me to actually realize that the gaze was the central organizing feature.
It's interesting that we sort of, what it is that we think that dog means there in that painting that we see. And at first you say, well, it makes sense that we first think, oh, it's reflecting faithfulness or fidelity. And it's a good starting point. But you say that then there's more to it. You write this, that it has become a way for us to imagine that all is well between us and nature. Would you say a little bit more about that? Because this gives us a sense that it's more than just, oh, faithful companion. There's something deeper maybe going on here.
Well, that's a very good point. I mean, if you ask most people, well, what's a dog in a painting mean? And they'll say, oh, the dog represents faithfulness. And if they've ever taken an art history course, they'll have seen the Van Eyck so-called painting, the Arnolfini Wedding, that has dogs right in front of it looking out at us. And the art history lecturer will have said, oh, that's a symbol of faithfulness because this is a wedding picture. Now, it turns out that that's not a wedding picture. That was a mislabel. The so-called bride's been dead for 11 or 12 years. So that doesn't work. Well, maybe it's a mourning picture. Well, not much else about it suggests it's a mourning picture. And then people who study this, has been studied a lot, they'll say, well, these other things, the candle also doesn't mean that it's a picture of mourning or something else. And so I started getting away from the idea that you're interested in what the dog means, that is to say, it stands for this or that, and got interested in the fact, what its subjective qualities, it's how does it work just in our minds. So the book is really less about the meaning of dogs, so forth, than it is about, you know, to put a term would be phenomenology, but you know, these things are fancy, the subjective feeling for each of us of what the dog does. And sometimes it just means that some fellow creature is looking out at us. And with the picture that we started with, this looking, it's just sort of, it's a touching relationship, you know, and it's a touching relationship. And there's something, I think, also sort of moving and compellingly interesting about the fact that some other species so different from us appears to be interested. So I think we as a species have lived with and been interested in animals for a very long time. and we represent this in our art. And then evolution has produced one creature that actually appears to be consistently interested in us, and that's quite moving.
Do you think that the way we interpret a dog in a painting, say, in art, says something about us? Because it seems like, of course, these are subjective impressions. But for example, you mentioned the art historian Simona Cohen, who pointed out the dogs in some of the painter Tintoretto's Last Supper paintings. In one, it seemed the dog was, oh, this is heresy. That means heresy there. And in another, it's, oh, this is wise perception. The dog is identifying Judas, the traitor. So is this all just flexible and subjective? What do you make of that?
My feeling about this is I'm sort of less interested personally in, is it one of these things or is another one of these things? It's probably a lot of them. But in some sense, that the dog is there, that it's interested in looking at this. Sometimes it recognizes Judas and you say, oh, this is a dog that gets it, that he's the traitor. Sometimes he stands for the traitor, though I don't often see that. I tried to look at these paintings both formally and how are they made, and then emotionally what these dogs do for me, and I think arguably for the painter, and less trying to guess at what the dog means. In other words, I think a lot of people looking at paintings place too much emphasis on the meaning of each thing. You know, what does this candlestick mean, or what does this thing
right.
mean? And of course, paintings do work like that.
Sure.
Huge numbers of paintings, like most 19th century art and almost all Impressionist art, doesn't mean anything. And yet they have these dogs in it that are very powerful and effective. So just as a predilection, just as how I like to look at art, I'm less for decoding it and more for trying to maybe analyze it as its emotional content.
I like how you say it's a book about an aesthetics of sociability rather than utility, which gets us to that social relationship that we have with dogs. And you get into the deep past. You point out dogs are the first, of course, domesticated animal, and the first by like thousands of years. But then the point about how they came to be part of our visual culture, that's another – well, this is how you describe it in the book, another step in this co-evolutionary history. And you write this, we joined them in myth. We thought about how they think and the meanings of their gestures. We represented all of this to ourselves in art. Would you explain what you're seeing there, this co-evolution in culture and art with dogs?
Part of that is part of the much deeper question and probably unanswerable question of why we as a species make art. But the fact is that we as a species have been art making since we can remember, and that animals have been central to this. And once we started being interested in our doing something with them, dogs were central to it. And then the story that I would try to continue in the book is that one of the first things we did together was hunt.
Yeah.
And huge numbers of myths in all cultures grow up about the hunt, and it sort of enters mythology. And then that mythology ends up becoming art. And a very deep question is, why do we do this at all?
Thomas LeCour. He's the Helen Fawcett Distinguished Professor of History Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. His book is called The Dog's Gaze, A Visual History. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery. With the answer to the age-old question of what's for dinner with chef-prepared food-to-go favorites, your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You know how your dog stares at you? Like, really stares. It's kind of intense, not creepy, but you can tell they're paying attention. The historian Thomas LeCour says dogs may have evolved this trait because, he says, they were the first animals that could comfortably share our living spaces. And the evidence suggests dogs were by our sides as we moved to the far corners of the earth. But what really interests him is that stare. He calls it the dog's gaze. It's the name of his book. And it explores the relationship between humans and dogs through the history of art. Over thousands of years, dogs appear in our paintings and sculptures and images more than any other animal. And their presence, he says, is almost never accidental. Let's get back to the conversation. Let's talk about the evolution of the gaze, because this is what the book is about in a lot of ways. Like, you mentioned gradually a dog developed this very particular visual ability to gaze, this motivation to make eye contact with humans, that's what connects us. It's that gaze. What do you understand about the way they evolved the gaze?
Well, all of this is, of course, in some sense, just so stories. I mean, we don't know. But we do know that the dog is descendant of the proto-gray wolf that humans encountered during the Ice Age, 70 or 80,000 years ago. And we know that these wolves have sclera. Their pupils are clearly differentiated from the rest of their eyes. And we know that they hunt and relate to each other visually as well as through calls. And we know that at some point humans linked up with these creatures, whether we were the ace hunter and they followed us, or they were the ace hunter and we followed them. No one knows how this relationship developed, but the dog's gaze developed from a wolf which gazes. So the speculation is there's something about this relationship which was selectively important. So wolves that were good at gazing at humans sort of hung around humans. Humans wanted to keep them around because they're interested in these creatures that looked at them. And eventually you get the dog. But even what the dog is puzzling, you know, because the dogs and wolves can breed fertily. So you could actually breed them. And there's tiny evolutionary genetic differences between the two, almost none. And yet you could work really hard with the wolf, and you could maybe make a wolf, modern wolf, do some of the visual things the dogs can do. An experimenter in Hungary had graduate students live with wolf puppies. You could never do this in this country. Live with wolf puppies for, you know, the better part of a year. So these were brought up as if they're dogs. And in these experiments to see how long would the wolf gaze and would the wolf act like a dog, some of the wolves were almost as good as wolf puppies as dog puppies with no training. So there's something evolutionarily happened that a wolf gradually becomes a dog.
Well, you mentioned that the dog's gaze evolved to a point where it actually changed the structure of its face. It made it more expressive.
Yes. Isn't that amazing? Older species of dogs, the Siberian Husky is one of these. Saluki's another one. I mean, I need to fact check this. So the older species of dogs don't have it, but dogs that seem to have evolved around 8,000 years ago had the ability to raise their eyes, sort of furrow their brow in the way we do when we're interested. So, you know, I think we often, when someone says something interesting, we'll raise our eyes to suggest that's a really interesting point. So at some point, dogs evolved the capacity to do that, and must have to do with the fact that dogs that showed this, quote, interest toward humans were selectively kept over dogs that didn't. But again, lots of things, as you know, are puzzling about evolution, and so much of these things end up being sort of just so stories. So we know a lot about dog genomics and where they developed and when they developed, and we know a lot about what they ate. We don't actually understand precisely what the selective pressures were that produces, you know, a dog.
Mm. So we move from evolution to culture and art. What do early stories and fables tell us about how a dog became our closest companion? What do you hear from Aesop and others?
The fabulist, who seems to have gotten many of these stories from earlier Mesopotamian stories, tells the following tale. So a dog meets a wolf, and the wolf is looking terrible. And the wolf says to the dog, "God, how do you manage to look so great?" The dog says, "Well, look, it's easy. I mean, you hang out with these people, and they feed you, and they give you a place to sleep, and they take care of you, and it's great." And then the wolf says, "So what's that around your neck?" And the dog says, "Oh, well, that's a collar." And the wolf says, "Well, so what's a collar?" Says, "Well, that's how they keep me there. They keep me with them using this sort of collar." So the wolf says, "So you're like a slave." And the dog says, "Well, not exactly like a slave, but, you know, I guess we're..." And the wolf says, "Well, I'm not going to give up my freedom for no matter how much food and comfort and warmth." And the wolf walks away. So that's a story. It's told over and over and over again. It's in 19th century illustrations of Aesop's fairy tales. So some version of this story is that it's a wolf that gave up its freedom. And then, ancillary versions of this. So I interpret the story of St. Francis and the so-called Wolf of Gubbio, which St. Francis is in the town, and there's a wolf that's destroying the crops and just being in general horrible to the inhabitants. And St. Francis speaks to him and says, "Brother Wolf, look, the townspeople feed you and leave out food for you, will you leave their crops and their people alone?" And the wolf agrees. And you see these wonderful pictures of St. Francis shaking hands with the wolf, you know, friends, or like medieval acts of fealty, in which is one right. person puts his hands into the hands of his superior. And you have a feeling, well, that's a wolf becoming a dog. Of getting with the program. So the rich versions of this is that somehow a wolf gives up the wilds being wild and becomes a dog. And in a way, it's a story of, you know, the story that Freud tells in Civilization and Discontents. It's a story of the advantages and also the downside, if you will, the psychic costs of civilization.
You also mention how important ways the dog in art doesn't reflect an actual reality, in the sense that you point out there are not very many images of dogs being vicious or rabid or dirty or polluting. What are you noticing there?
Well, I mean, look, dogs in some sense, you know, had a bad rap that was not totally undeserved. I mean, they were rabid dogs. Not as many as people thought, but you don't need very many to make you afraid. And they were obviously very ferocious dogs. And artists are by and large not interested in this because, as I try to suggest, you know, dogs in some sense are ways of understanding the harmony of the world and not the disharmony of the world. And in a way, it's also, I mean, we have relatively few pictures of human cruelty and violence. We have some pictures in anti-war art, obviously going back. But by and large, I think art is by and large better and more interested in representing coherence than it is in representing violence.
Well, you say dogs appear in art, you say, as part of the social contract.
Yeah. I mean, it's part, you know, we want to represent that we have a deal with these dogs, a social contract. And I think, and this is more speculative, that by and large, art is interested in representing a social contract between humans. And we obviously have an art of discord, but there's and we've had, God knows, a lot of discord, but the art of discord is very small compared to the art of concord, if you will. You know, we turn to art, I think, in some sense, to be, you know, reconciled to our condition, to understand that there is actually a contract, even though it seems to be broken, both between humans and between us and animals. So, so there's very little. What there is in the so-called bad dog, the dog is, you might say, the material dog. I mean, Rembrandt is fascinated by the dog as a is a material creature. So there's a famous etching that I talk about of a dog pooping in the middle of the scene of the Good Samaritan.
Yeah.
And in some sense, I think Rembrandt puts this dog in there as a as an emblem of, you know, of the physicality, first of the body of the injured person, and generally of the weight of the injured person. So dogs are often there just to represent materiality, in some sense, the fact that we are, in some sense, all of us, you know, defecated, pee, and so forth, as a sign of the sort of, how to put it, animality, may not be the right word, but that we are all material creatures and not just idealized subjects.
Do you think the dog also is acting kind of like an intermediary between the artist and the viewer? It's a vehicle in that sense.
That's a very good point. I think it's absolutely right. I think that's what I try to suggest often is that the dog is there in the position of the painter looking at the picture. I mean, as if we're the painter, the dog is in the painting showing us where the painter would like us to look.
Yeah.
The dog is looking out at the painter. So the dog and the painter have this this multifaceted relationship in which with one another. I say sometimes the dog is sort of the doppelganger, the double for the painter. And I quote Cézanne, who says he thinks that a painter should see like a dog, where I think he means not that the painter should have a preconceived notion of what the world looks like, but should produce the world out of his imagination as the painting progresses.
Do you think it's? I got a sense that in some of these pictures, it's the painter or the character in the dog in the painting saying, "Hey, are you guys seeing this? You don't seem to be paying attention to this thing that's happening." Actually, why don't you take us through the finding of Moses? Because that seems like a really good example of people not seeing and the dog actually seeing what's playing out there.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of these scenes where you have the central feature of Moses, and so I got interested in Tiepolo because of a phrase by the brilliant art historians Svetlana Alpers and Michael Baxendall on their book on Tiepolo, and they say that Tiepolo relieves dogs of all social responsibility. A good dog registers pictorial problems engaged. That is to say, a dog sort of solves a problem for the painter. So what you see in this Tiepolo, the finding of Moses, in the middle is Moses being found at the top right center is the princess who finds him. But the real character is Moses' sister Miriam, and it's a dog that looks at her and saying, "Oh," speaking to the princess, "I can take care of him.
Yeah,
my mom can take care of him." So the central, there's this thing of Moses, but you really, when you look at the picture, I think that the white dog looking at Miriam is sort of in some ways more prominent, but it solves the picture. It gets you, the viewer, to start looking off at this other world that's out there that's going to continue the story.
There's this image from Giotto from a fresco cycle in a chapel. I wanted you to sort of describe this. And what I think is interesting, this is how you put it in the book. You say dogs humanize humans. Would you just take us through the scene that's here and what the dog is doing? Just tell us about this. People who don't know this image.
Giotto is often the first painter one sees in a Western art history class. He was said by the scholars in the Renaissance are rated by the person who invented really our way of representing. So he's a really central painter, and the story he tells in this cycle in the Scavone Chapel is a story of the Virgin, and he tells that he represents this sort of pre-birth of the Virgin, and so Joachim and his wife Anna don't have children, and Joachim goes to the temple and offers a sacrifice in the hopes of his wife having a child, and he's rejected. And so the painting in the scene shows him rejected in the temple. And then he walks into the desert. Now, this story has been told in art, Byzantine art, lots of times, never a dog. So when Giotto paints it, Joachim arrives in the desert, and you see him in this red, crimson robe, halo over his head because he's already represented as a saint. And his shepherds look at each other like, who is this guy? He's our master, I guess he owns the sheep. But they're very puzzled. But the dog looks up at him, and he looks at the dog, and the dog is about to put his feet up on Joachim's cloak. And I read this as saying, gosh, Giotto puts this in there as a dog who recognizes the humanity of this creature, who is in distress. And in my way of seeing it, it just makes the emotional content of this picture, intensifies it. And then the next series in this picture, an angel comes and tells Joachim that God has answered his prayer and that Anna is with child, which is going to be Mary. And the angel appears out of this dark, gorgeous blue sky. And between the angel and Joachim is rocks, and a dog is sitting on the rock, sort of guarding the sleeping saint. So it's a very, to me at least, emotionally powerful part of this painting, and it's a complete invention of Giotto's. That is to say, the story doesn't need dogs. We're not painting a narrative in which, like if you're painting a portrait of Ulysses, where you would have to have Argos there. He makes it up, and my argument, he makes it up obviously for visual purposes, but visual purposes being essentially emotional purposes, purposes that make us engage with this idea of a creature, of the power of a creature recognizing us as humans, even when other humans don't.
Dogs are conveying something about human emotion. And I think it's really interesting the role that they play in art, in what seems to be the artist trying to convey, well, melancholy or depression, you know, in a time when it was hard to talk about, if they did at all, confusing about what mental health would actually mean. But there it is often. And in some ways, you say sometimes it's just a dog, keeping a dejected figure company, is how you put it. But we'll talk about that.
Yeah, and in our world, everyone will have noticed, first of all, noticed the number of dog adoptions during COVID. Lonely people got dogs. Anyone, sadly, going through the cities of the Western, other parts of the world, find the unhomed with their dogs as companions. But in the Western art tradition, the dog is a creature that keeps you company however you feel. In other words, humans might say it's maybe a bore to stick around with someone who's that depressed. But not a dog. The dog will either say, well, maybe I can cheer him up, which is, the dogs don't say anything, of course, but the dogs act like they're cheerio, or they just lie there comfortably with you, sort of, I don't know, what's the word? Moping?
Yeah.
And there's a
whole... mention Lucian Freud's Girl with a White Dog. This was from the 1951, I think it was. That's a good one to maybe describe. It's in the book.
Well, this is the painting you're referring to is called Girl with a White Dog. It's a relatively early Lucian Freud. It's his first wife. It seems to me she's wearing a yellow robe. One breast is exposed. It's a melancholy, a picture of a woman bereft, perhaps. And on her extended leg and on the robe is a dog, probably a greyhound, with its head heavily on her thigh, looking, eyes sort of halfway open, looking, what does one want to say, not quite asleep, not quite awake, but content to be there with her. Its body follows the contour of her leg. I mean, it's the baseline of the painting that shows her leg and the dog on the horizontal axis, and she's on the vertical axis. So it's in some sense the dog very much sharing her heaviness, if that's the word. It's heavy on her body.
Yeah.
And so I think it again, I don't think the dog stands for or means melancholy. I think it's the dog that's sympathetic with her, and because of its melancholy, is something's about it, about weightiness, conveys that quality in the image.
Thomas LeCour, his book is The Dog's Gaze, A Visual History. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from our members. Find out how at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Thomas LeCour. We're talking about his new book, The Dog's Gaze. You write that new technologies have now opened up these new possibilities for, you know, dogs in art. I wanted to ask you about how dogs figure in the art of the modern world. Let's talk about film. What do you see in films that tells you about dogs and their humans?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, look, from the very first films we have, they're dogs. Now,
yeah.
Whether they, and we don't know, I mean.
If they were meant to be there, you mean?
No. Well, some dogs we're pretty sure aren't meant to be there. So there's a Lumiere film in which they're filming something and the dog, of people leaving a factory, and the dog just walks through. Clearly, yeah. That dog wasn't meant to be there. It's just that they haven't figured out yet that they hadn't yet gotten this convention between the inside of a paint of a film and the outside of a film, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, the film guys call it the diegetic and the rest of the world. So that's, we know that isn't meant there. But then in other of these films, it's clear that the dog is meant to be part of the, is meant to be part of the story. But so one of the very earliest, I think the second earliest Edison film shows a guy, a clip, shows a guy doing deep D-bends with a baton, and it's a dog watching him. So whether it's done by one of Edison's associates, whether the dog was meant to be there or just, you know, we're going to film this 30-second clip and the dog is there, it's very hard to say. We don't know. We don't know. But we do know that very early on in the history of film, people started, and this is true of the Lumieres, people started making movies in which the dog is relevant to the to the to the story and started producing, you know, dog stories.
Yeah, Rescued by Rover from 1905 and
Rover became, and, you know, the, as you know, one of the most popular dog names for a long time because
it was Rover.
Because of that movie, and then the Rin Tin Tin movies in the 20s. I mean, saved the studio. I mean, yeah. Rin Tin Tin was one of the biggest star of the age. And then of course the Lassie stories. I think visually, it's very much part of the story we're talking about because of the way these creatures are represented is they're seeing, just like artists, still painters and photographers have them see, and part of it just that it that though goes back to the very beginning that dogs actually in fact are a central part of human narratives, and so there's just a lot of stories about dogs,
right.
In real life, in the life of art,
yeah,
there's a lot of stories about dogs. So dogs want to come back, and so then you have Lassie come home, and that becomes sort of part of popular culture too, as well as you know.
Yeah. So yeah, what about still photography? You mentioned how the book You mentioned how the new technology of still photography opened these new ways of seeing dogs and humans together.
I guess I would suggest that it's less new ways of seeing the dog. It's just that it proliferates these orders of magnitude. So you can go to any antique shop and find old pictures, and they're just, they're, everyone who takes pictures of the families have dogs. I bought six of them, taken with a brownie spotlight, these brown photographs in a coal town in West Virginia. So someone takes these pictures and they have a dog in them. So it becomes conventional. Some pictures, of course, is not conventional, like Queen Victoria with her dog Sharp in mourning.
Well, I want to ask about that because I think this image is really interesting. I'm looking at it now. This is from 1866, Queen Victoria with Sharp, her dog, in mourning. They're at Balmoral. So she's, of course, in after Albert has died, she's in black, as she always was after he died. But you say that the mourning dog joined with the mourning queen, and it was an image that hundreds of thousands of I think it's a kind of a great image. The dog is leaning into her. I think it's the best thing I've seen with Queen Victoria in it, as far as the photograph goes.
So did tens of thousands of people who bought the picture. So it was a very popular image of Queen Victoria, and
yeah,
the dog actually is sympathetic to Queen Victoria. In a way that there's no image of a human being that's sympathetic with her.
Yeah, yeah.
The other pictures you ask about, it becomes like my picture of Heidi, the dog, walking, the picture I took as a kid. Somehow the convention of dogs entering pictures becomes part of that new, is adopted by the new technology. So I have a picture of my wife's great-grandparents on their farm, with their dog Frisky. So it's a kind of, they had lots of cats. So we know they're not just dog people and they don't like cats. We know that we have a historical record that they like cats. And yet when they have themselves photographed in front of their barn, there they are with their dog. And then I have a picture from a colleague of mine who just wrote an autobiography where I saw this godforsaken farm in Saskatchewan. You could see the shadow of the photographer, and the photographer set up the picture such that the dog is in front of these sod houses. So what I would suggest is that photography multiplies the possibilities and is done within the conventions of a painting. We know that photography adopts the structures of paintings, but I was sort of struck by how powerfully and how copiously it did that. And if you look, the books collected of movie star pictures, and the number of movie stars that are painted with their dogs, even if they didn't have dogs, it becomes a convention to show someone in a family with a dog.
Here's something that is really interesting, though, that and you raise this question for me anyway in the book. You let me read something that you write. You write that for the artists in this book, a dog is an image. A dog in an image was a conscious choice. It was a question of form, for example, or narrative. But then you say, in the vast archive of amateur still photography, the dog is there because it is there. It's looking with and at humans. And this was the question I got from that. With mass photography, do you think the presence of dogs in images is different or less special in some way? Because you say mass photography has made seeing and being seen by dogs a commonplace of humanity. Not that that's bad, but has it changed the way we see?
That's a really interesting question. I hadn't quite thought about the formulation the way that you posed it. I mean, I suppose what I'm trying to say is that a painter is standing in front of a blank canvas, and unless he's doing a mythological story that needs the dog for the story, like Venus and Adonis, where we know in the story Adonis is drawn away from Venus by his dogs and gets killed. And so, if you're going to do a mythological painting, you have to have the dog. And there are a bunch of other such stories. So, if it's not that, we don't have to have a dog. The painter has to choose to have one. The way that we discussed Giotto adding the dog to a story where it had never been painted before. So that's what I wanted to say with that. Now, with photographs, I think what I'm trying to say is that except for studio photographs, in which it is a choice. It's an older convention. People bring their dogs to studios in the 19th century and a photograph with them, and there's a whole tradition of that. For snapshots, it meant to be just spontaneous in the world. So I don't want to say that people who took the snapshots I include and the millions and tens of millions of others consciously thought about having a dog in it in the way that a painter had to think or someone going into the studio had to think. What I wanted to say by this is that this very long convention of imagining us with dogs in art has translated into, has made its way into the spontaneous art of photography. You might want to say, let me put it this way. If there were telephone posts in the picture, you would change the picture so that you wouldn't see the telephone posts.
Yeah.
Right? If there is a dog in the picture, you say, oh, perfect.
Hmm.
You know, in other words, you don't choose to have the dog in the way that a painter might, but it's part of it's a standard composition to have the dog in the picture. So, and that I suppose grows out of the same, some ways, think of where you put it, both grow out of the same tradition, which is that dogs are part of human life. And whether in snapshots or in deeply thought out paintings, when we're representing human life, we're interested in including the dog. I think that would be the answer to what you say. Just that, you know, I don't want to suggest that snapshots have the same thought that goes into them as, you know, the paintings we've talked about.
There is one last image I want to ask you about.
Yep, which is that?
This is the final image in the book that, as you say, captures the claims about what the book is getting at.
The Joan Brown, The Dancers in the City.
Joan Brown's painting, The Dancers in a City. There's a dog there on the left-hand side of the painting. It's not clear whose dog it is, as you say in the book. It doesn't really matter. What matters is the dog has entered, as you say, the social world of the image. Talk about why you ended with this image and what you're seeing here.
Well, I mean, I love this image. I have a reproduction of it on my desk. And so it struck me as a way, as you just put it, it doesn't have to be there. And there's a couple dancing on this floor. You see the music, this cream of staff and notes going to the bottom. You see the San Francisco skyline in the background. The man is only drawn in with the lines. The woman is clothed and fully painted. And there's a dog coming into the picture on the left, as it does in so many other paintings. I made a big story about how they come into Velázquez's Feast at Canaan, which is the biggest Velázquez painting of all, the biggest painting in the Louvre. And so I make a lot about dogs coming in from the side. And here's this dog coming in from the side of the picture, and not so much looking at them, but looking at us. And I can't help but look at this picture and say, the dog is really looking at us and saying, are you paying attention? You know, just so it's the photographer, the painter asking, demanding that we look at this. I mean, how can you resist that dog? Right? It has to, at least in my vision, it's looking at us and saying, out here, and saying, are you seeing this? Come on. Get with the program, you guys.
Yeah.
And if a painting without the dog, I mean, you'd probably look at it. But it's nowhere near as enticing. I mean, if you put your hand over the dog and just look at the paint, the couple, I mean, it's fine. But it's not the paint. It's not that. It's not close to that painting.
Yeah.
You know. So it is a dog, as I said, that's doing what so many of the dogs in this book are doing, which is demanding our attention, telling us what to look at, and connecting us with the image. It's also, I think, if you think about it, which I hadn't before you asked, the most, the most carefully painted of the images. In other words, her dress is articulated, but the dog's face and the dog's body is much clearer than the faces of either the two humans. It's a demanding image. Don't you think?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, yeah, so that's, and I thought it kind of sums it up. And it's a beautiful picture. It's, again, we started by talking about the design of the book. I thought it's a wonderful design that they have the whole page there and then the last half page of text. It makes the book feel finished.
Thomas LaCour, thank you very much.
Thank you for such an interesting conversation.
Thomas LaCour, he's an emeritus professor of history at Berkeley. His book is The Dog's Gaze, A Visual History. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can find us on Instagram at Radio West, on YouTube at KUER 90.1. You can also email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Aidan Oneida, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. I'm Doug Fabrizio.